So the discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb has helped with uncovering Egypt's history in the most uncertain of periods. How do these discoveries reframe how we view history and ancient Egyptian culture?
Well, the interesting thing about Tutankhamun himself was that he was erased from the history books by the ancient Egyptians themselves, owing to his association with a very difficult period of history where his father, King Akhenaten, perhaps best known as the husband of Nefertiti, or at least the king of whom Nefertiti was his chief wife, had sought to overturn the religious order in Egypt, which was repudiated after he died. And so Tutankhamun, as his son, as Akhenaten's son, was seen, and indeed the wider family of royal family at that time, were seen as part of this difficult period and were all erased from the history books of Egypt. So suddenly to find the tomb of King Tutankhamun essentially placed a window back into this very shadowy era. Although some of the other kings were better known, Tutankhamun himself was only known from very fragmentary archaeological data. And Howard Carter, who found the tomb, always believed that the tomb of this king was still to be found in the Valley of the Kings. And he had worked there for a number of years and was very familiar with the landscape. And as I said, believed that the tomb had not yet been discovered, and on the basis that some objects were found in the valley with this king's name on it.
Oh, wow. That's quite a breadcrumb trail, isn't it?
It is a breadcrumb trail. And indeed, but, you know, most of the well-known kings are found on the Egyptian records. The Egyptians themselves kept quite detailed records of the kings and the order of the kings, and often the reign length was known. So, but for this particular period, in the middle of the 14th century, from about 1350 down to around 1330, 1320, is very controversial. It was so for the Egyptians of that time.
So what significant artefacts can we expect to be in the Grand Egyptian Museum from this tomb?
Well, clearly all the major pieces that have been on display in the Egyptian Museum for so many decades will be on display. So the ones that we all know, the very iconic pieces, the gold mask, for example, or the coffins, the various all the jewellery, these are well known in the history books and through and just simply Googling artefacts from Tutankhamun's tomb. But there are a large number of other artefacts that are less well known. So items of clothing, for example, will be there. There was some food food remains left in different pots and cases. Those will presumably be on display. Just lesser known things like some of the ceramics, some of the pottery, that is also quite important archaeologically, but perhaps less appealing to the visitor. And look, many, many small pieces that have just simply, there's not been room to display in the Egyptian Museum itself. So the Egyptian government is rolling out a huge display of the artefacts from Tutankhamun's tomb, and so it's understood that there'll be quite a lot on display that have never been seen before.
So this iconic death mask that everyone has seen, it's an incredible piece of artistry. And what did this mask reveal about the craftsmanship and technology of ancient Egypt?
Well, it was helpful in a number of respects, is in that there's really never been anything like this discovered up until that point. And so the understanding of the craftsmanship, it was made out of solid gold. It was hammered and beaten into its shape. Craftsmanship that's been that's evident in the very delicate way that the face has been rendered of the of Tutankhamun, although there is some debate as to whether the mask actually depicts Tutankhamun himself, but that's another story. Maybe it belonged to one of his relatives. But the gold mask is also inlaid with different semi-precious stones and pieces of glass. And so just looking at the semi-precious stones, for example, gives us a window into the trade networks of the period. So the blue stone used in the mask is actually largely lapis lazuli, which has been traded and exchanged from as far away as Afghanistan. That is the only known source of lapis lazuli in ancient times. It still is the only known source of lapis. And so just that lapis itself helps us see the nature and extent of the trade networks that were available to the Egyptians and the region at that time. So there's on multiple levels, it's a beautiful object. it's really represents the craftsmen at the height of their powers, in addition to which helping us to understand something of even the trade relations of that period.
That's quite amazing how just something as such as simple as a mask can open our eyes into such a world that's been been covered up for so long and bring it up to life. And that's pretty cool and really incredible.
Oh, well, you can imagine Howard Carter, when it was found. The mask itself was nestled deep in the burial chamber of Tutankhamun. And again, this was an intact assemblage consisting of the body of Tutankhamun in an inner coffin. And then there were a series of other coffins, nested coffins that got larger and larger. I mean, think of a Russian doll, for example. That's what his burial assemblage was like, which was encased in a sarcophagus, which is encased in a gold wooden shrine that was, you know, covered with gold leaf and inscriptions. I mean, this was a very, very elaborate burial. And you can imagine the astonishment of Howard Carter and his team when they took the lid off that inner coffin where the final resting place of the king was, and they had this gold mask staring up at them. Mm. This must have just been, I can't imagine what that moment was like. And not only that, but the mask itself which covered the head and shoulders of the king, had still evidences of the flowers that were placed on the body for its burial, and indeed the flowers and the plants that were associated with this with the body, associated with and found with the mask, have been used to help identify the date of or the season in which the body was buried. So there's been this multi-layered archaeological story that can be told just from the burial, just from the actual burial of the king himself. In addition to which, there are, you know, this very complex accoutrement of artifacts in the burial chamber, and nothing like this had been seen. And you have to appreciate that all these kings had magnificent burial chambers with packed to the gunwales with the most exquisite artifacts. I mean, one can imagine what the pyramids must have had. And there was nothing in the pyramids which was seen by any Western archaeologists. I'm talking the three pyramids at Giza here. They had been robbed in antiquity forever. Yeah. And so nothing there. Yeah. But to suddenly see this window into a largely intact assemblage of a king who was not even a major king. I mean, this king was 19 when he died and only reigned for about 10 years, which his burial equipment itself is largely recycled from other sources. So there's some from different members of his family, mm-hmm. which actually still have their names on it, that indicates he died quite quickly and was unable to have a fully personalised burial of the equipment, of the tomb equipment itself. But either way, this was just an incredible window into the wealth, the power, the acquisition of resources, the economic strength of Egypt at this time, which was likewise at its height, the intricacies of this story about the royal family, which has been told through the DNA of Tutankhamun and his relatives. Now we're piecing that historical story together, and understanding of this very tumultuous period of history, which the Egyptians themselves tried to forget in ancient times. The Egyptians themselves today, of course, are very aware of it, but in ancient times it was, and indeed that's one of the reasons why the tomb itself was untouched, although Howard Carter did find evidence of it having been broken into in antiquity, and the holes in the opening in the original doorway were plastered over, and there was evidence of that. He could see it had been resealed, mm-hmm. and so and indeed when he got into the tomb, found that things had been hastily repacked and some of the boxes had been opened and things removed, so there was a little bit of disarray in the tomb itself. But the tomb then was resealed, recovered, and then lost to antiquity, and it's unsure why. There was probably a rainstorm that might have brought a lot of debris over the tomb. By the time it's actually buried underneath a later tomb for King Ramses VI, and so the construction debris of that tomb, by which time, of course, Tutankhamun's tomb location must have been not known, the debris had been placed over the area where his tomb was. And so who would think there was a tomb in that location?
That's absolutely fascinating. Like, I know I would be terrified if I was in this spooky place where, you know, you hear about the curses, and surely Howard Carter would have known about the curses. And, you know, and to see that shining bright gold, I would have ran straight out of there.
Well, you know, by the time he got to the gold mask, Carnarvon was already dead.
Yep.
Lord Carnarvon, there were already stories circulating about this curse. And, of course, it's known that tombs sometimes had inscriptions on them to ward off the robber and ward off those who would do evil to the deceased. So, you know, this idea of tombs being a place that one wouldn't violate was certainly known from other sites. But the particular circumstances and the sensational reception of the tomb's discovery globally actually was put in the hands of a single media outlet, and there was a lot of competition for the stories arising out of the tomb's ongoing excavation, which incidentally took 10 years. But because a single media outlet was given the exclusive story, this caused a lot of consternation amongst competing media, and the tomb's journalists were sent there. There was a lot of gossip going around. In the absence of facts, there were stories and rumours going around, particularly when Carnarvon died, and he died within 5 months of the tomb having been discovered. It was, oh, my gosh, you know, he's victim of the curse of the tomb. You know, this actually was a very sensational media story, essentially constructed by the press, because there was, it was hard to get actual information as to what was going on, especially so early in the tomb's archaeological history.
Yeah. So we're speaking before we started the interview, and I got completely confused. I thought this was the 100 years of the opening of Tutankhamun's tomb, but you said it's actually the 100 years of the discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb. And you mentioned that there was a bit of a story as to why it took 3 weeks to open the tomb.
That's right. Indeed. Well, Howard Carter, he had excavated in the Valley of the Kings for a while, and he'd been working with Lord Carnarvon, the fifth Earl of Carnarvon, for a few years already. And there'd been a lot of people trawling over the Valley of the Kings looking for tombs, and quite a number had in fact been found, of which Howard Carter was part of some of those discoveries. But because he'd found this evidence of these small inscriptions with Tutankhamun's name on them in the Valley of the Kings, he was of the view that Tutankhamun's tomb was still not found, was undiscovered. And so it got to 1922, you know, post-war. He had pulled out all the maps of the Valley of the Kings and mapped where everybody had worked, what was their concession. And indeed, it's no, you know, when you dig in Egypt, you're given a piece of land in the desert, or if you're digging in the desert, which is what's known as your concession, and that's where you excavate. And so the Valley of the Kings had X person working over there and Y person working to the west and someone to the north. So he knew what the concessions were that everybody had been working on and where they'd worked over the decades. Mm. And he went to Carnarvon in early 1922 and said, look, this part, I think this tomb is to be found. Here's my map. I think it's in this area. And he literally drew a shape on the map, which was, and he said, this is the one part of the valley that hasn't been excavated. I think we should dig here. And Carnarvon said, look, you know what? I'm not going to fund that. We've been there a while. We've not found, you know, any splendid stuff. We've found a lot of important material, but don't think it's worth it.
Yep.
Carter was so convinced that it was there that he said, look, I will fund this myself. Whereupon Carnarvon said, okay, whatever, one more season. And so he goes into the field. This is Howard Carter, into the field, starts on the 1st of November. 3 days later, he's finding steps going down into the ground.
3 days.
So he starts digging. And imagine this. I mean, literally, it's there are steps there into the ground because this is the subterranean tomb. And after a couple of days, he's actually found the stairway and the blocked door, which is essentially a plastered face, with seals pressed into what was in its day wet plaster. Mm. So these seals of the priests of the necropolis, and he finds the top of that doorway. And at that point, it's like, right, I need to cover this up. I need to. He contacted, sent a telegram to Carnarvon and said, you got to come. I think we found something. So wow. 3 weeks later, of course, because of course he comes out on a boat.
Yep.
He's got, I think he did. He would have made part. He would have. He may have flown. I think in 1922, perhaps he did. But either way, it was 3 weeks before he got there. Carnarvon got there, and when he got there, on November 26, they opened the tomb. So, and then, of course, the rest is history.
That's absolutely fascinating. It's incredible to think that, you know, this one person who had a gut instinct about where to dig, 3 days later, his prayers were answered.
Yeah, I know, it's incredible. And I think that's part of the mystique of the story, is it's actually a very multi-layered story. You've got this king that was cancelled from history by the ancient Egyptians, right? You've got this this interplay of wealth, of the kind of lords and wealthy English, Americans and others who were looking for artifacts and tombs.
Yeah.
You've got this person of Howard Carter who was not wealthy. He wasn't schooled in Egyptology. He was an artist and came to ancient Egypt a number of years before and had worked on excavations. He couldn't read ancient Egyptian. The Egyptology was very much in that, although he would have picked quite a bit up over time, but yeah. He wasn't formally schooled in the language. He didn't go to Oxford. He didn't go to Cambridge. So you've got this level of academic and wealth hierarchy, basically funding and doing the archaeology, and this discovery is made by this quintessentially sort of middle-class Englishman
yep.
who finds the find of the century, and in this, and believing in himself, which is kind of like, you know, it's a Cinderella story in and of itself, which is just a fascinating thing. And then of course you've got the desert setting and the sort of romance of the desert that was around at that time as well, and the whole kind of orient, the idealizing orientalist view of the East, etc. It's all sort of very exotic, and then you throw in, you know, a tomb full of gold and precious objects, and we're still talking about it.
I know, it's absolutely fascinating. I could sit here and talk about this all day with you, but unfortunately we're going to have to wrap it up. This has been absolutely incredible. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Yeah, Maddie, thank you so much for having me. Thank you.